have police photographing our license plates.
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to The Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm Marcello Rolando. The mission of The Reasonable Voice is to connect the dots between politics and finance, the need for better and more affordable education, our humanity, world peace, and of course, the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal opportunity. The Reasonable Voices are advocates prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world by evoking and embracing the creative artist and political unity as solutions to our challenges. My guest today is director and producer Robert Lemelson, who is also an anthropologist and documentary filmmaker, whose work focuses on the relationship of culture, psychology, and personal experience in Indonesia. We're going to talk a lot today about a subject we actually don't talk too much about in America, and so wake up because it's a roller coaster ride. Welcome, Robert, to the show. I know your specialty is Southeast Asia studies and psychological anthropology, so you're making documentary films about polygamy in Bali?
Yeah, so I'm an anthropologist at faculty at UCLA, and I've been working in Indonesia for about 20 years.
Yes.
And initially starting mostly research, and then starting about 14, 15 years ago, began filming my research, and then starting about maybe 7 or 8 years ago, we actually began making films. So in the last 15 years, we've made about a dozen films on a wide range of topics on genocide in Indonesia, mass killings after the 1965 purported communist coup.
Yes.
We did a six-part series about culture and mental illness called Afflictions. We did a film, Standing on the Edge of a Thorn, which is about the sex trade, films on ritual life, and other topics, kind of at this intersection of culture and psychology.
Yes.
And our latest is a 7-year project that we're just releasing now called Bitter Honey, which is about three polygamous families in Bali, which is one of the islands in Indonesia.
Yes. That is the most comprehensive answer to my question, and we covered a lot of what I was going to ask you already. But following three families who practice polygamy, that is one husband but several wives, over a 7-year period in Bali, Indonesia. And given what you've said, it's not a rhetorical question, but I'd like for our audience to understand why do women do this? Why do they agree to this?
Yeah, it's the film explores that. It's actually one of the first questions the film looks at is why would women be a second or third or fourth wife? It doesn't seem, and particularly coming from the West, from the United States, it's illegal. It's considered bigamy here.
Yes.
Of course, and much of the rest of the, not even of the rest of the world, but in sub-Saharan Africa, the Middle East, insular Southeast Asia, Malaysia, and Indonesia, which is a pretty big swath of the world if you look on a map.
Yes.
Polygamy is legal.
Yes.
So it's a valid kinship form, regardless of, you know, the way we may view it here. But so going back to your question, what the film shows is actually the answer is the women fall in love. They meet these guys who are already married, and the guys are very charming and sweet, and they become intimate, sometimes quite rapidly, in some cases become pregnant. And when they're brought to the man's compound, his family compound, they realize he's already married, and by that time it's often too late for them. So they're basically what we found in the film is deception was the central kind of component in the early relationships, other than love. The women were fooled.
Yes.
And what you need to understand, your listeners maybe need to understand, in a place like Indonesia, unmarried women, particularly women who've been sexually active, or particularly women who've had an out-of-wedlock pregnancy, are in a very, very difficult social position.
Yes.
In fact, typically women who have children out of wedlock are kicked out of the village, sent to the cities, and usually enter into the sex trade.
Yes.
And so it's really a better position for them, at least at that point in their lives, to become a second or third or fourth wife than to be an unmarried or single mother.
You know, what struck me initially in watching the documentary, and let's repeat again, it's Bitter Honey, production of Elemental Productions, and we're speaking with its director. What struck me is that Americans in general tend to see the world as America, you know, that everywhere is like us, and if it isn't, we go to war with them, and then we make it like us, and everybody will be happy. But the reality is, what's going on in Bali and in other places in Indonesia, where you are doing so much great work, is that there is a heritage, a history, if you will. I mean, it's the first time I've heard karma blamed for polygamy, but when you listen to the argument, you go, but what about the second point, as well as educating us? Not every place is like us, and we need to know. As you said, if a lady is not married, she's in trouble. If she gets divorced, she loses everything. But this hard fact that kept hitting me over and over again was that the husband very often woos the woman, and they, you know, they become lovers, as you say, but he never mentions that he already has a wife. Now, part of that, of course, is because he can get away with it, and it's legal, polygamy in Bali. But the situation when they get back home, and your documentary treats this so well, the different reactions from the different women of different ages when they find out. Can we talk a little about that?
Yeah, it's going back to an earlier point you made about Americans' understanding of the rest of the world. Anthropology rose in American society as a scientific discipline for just that point, to explore and educate the public. That's one of the public missions of anthropology, that things are, you know, really quite different in other parts of the world.
Yes.
And that we should have a respect for many, though perhaps not all, forms of difference. Polygamy is one of the ones that I think most people in the United States would have a very difficult time,
yes,
accepting as a kinship form. And it's part of the reason it's not part of our cultural tradition,
yes,
coming out of a kind of Judeo-Christian European context, where really there wasn't much polygamy unless you go really quite far back into the Old Testament,
yes,
where polygamy was an accepted and common kinship form. Okay. But going back to the question of the reactions of the women, I think the women adjust themselves to this position of being a second or third or fourth wife. If you look back in Balinese history, I think polygamy was much more common in pre-colonial times. Bali was conquered by the Dutch in 1911, so most of their history was really not under colonial regimes or under westernization. So mm-hmm. in that period, even under Dutch colonialism, polygamy was still quite common. Right now it's becoming less and less common as Bali adjusts to globalization and the modern world, and some of the traditional aspects of Balinese social life are breaking down.
Mm-hmm.
For example, Bali's patrilineal and patrilocal, meaning that women move into male compounds. So if you can imagine a typical traditional family compound in Bali, can be 100 to 150 people all connected through kinship. So it would be a grandfather, his brother, the male children and their wives, the sons and their wives and children, all living in one family compound. Mm. You can imagine living with 150 of your uncles and aunts. That is not an atypical compound in Bali.
Wow.
And in that context, polygamy is not so odd,
uh-huh,
if you spend time in that part of the world. What the film shows, at least in the families we worked with, because of the issues of jealousy and economics and really power dynamic between the husbands and between the husbands over the wives. I mean, the women are really quite subjugated.
Yes.
It's generally not the happiest circumstance for many of the women. It's there's a lot of pain involved for these women to be, you know, to have to share their husbands and in some cases live in the same family compound with the other wives. It's not big love or sister wives. I mean, that's a very different take
yes.
on polygamy. And, you know, how accurate that is, you know, the reality show, at least, I don't really know.
Yes, yes. I have to say that when you say it's sort of changing, I got the impression from your documentary, it's a mixed message because in addition to the three families you followed for 7 years, you also talked with neighbors, primarily men, who and tried to get their opinion about what they thought. And one person and guy in particular, I thought, or his take on it didn't bode well for the future change. Now, the other two gentlemen, one out and out said he didn't want to have several wives, but at the other extreme, in other words, you had a great cross-section of people to talk to about this who are there living in the midst of it or next door or whatever. But this one gentleman seemed to think it was the right thing to do, and he planned on continuing it and didn't see what was wrong. And I just wonder, how does that speak to the society overall? I mean, the percentage of polygamous marriages is relatively small, considering, yes, to the population?
Yes. So they are in the single digits.
Okay. So it's still, while we find it alarming because Americans, you know, find such things alarming, it is a small percentage, but what's the potential for this changing?
Well, you know, it's interesting because all the children in the families, we asked all of them, when you grow up, or in some cases they were already married,
yes.
the children, would you want to have, you know, be in a polygamous union? And to a person, they all said no.
Yes.
Now, whether that will change, particularly on the boys' part when they get older, I can't really say.
Yeah.
But I do think you're going to see a diminishment, particularly as kind of the forces of globalization and the awareness in a place like Bali of the how something like polygamy would be viewed, not everywhere, because Indonesia gets a lot of its focus towards the Middle East as a largely Muslim society, and, you know, polygamy is somewhat common in many societies. Even in a few societies in sub-Saharan Africa, it's in 30% or 40% of marriages are still polygamous.
Wow.
So Indonesia is oriented towards that way, but it's already also oriented towards kind of this globalized world where polygamy is viewed very, very negatively.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that filters down to the kids' perception and also the society at large. There's forces of nationalism in Indonesian society that if you're a government, a civil service worker, or you're in the military, you may not, by law, have multiple wives.
Uh-huh.
So there's those forces pushing against the future of polygamy. My prediction is you will see it diminish in the next generation.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it certainly diminished from the previous generation. We have one family with an 80-year-old patriarch who had 10 wives.
Yes.
And we put that in there as kind of pointing towards what polygamy was like in the past when it was more common, where men could have upwards of, I mean, there's apocryphal stories of men having 100 wives.
Yes.
And so that was in the past. So I would think that it's probably going to diminish, if not disappear, in the next generation or two.
Yes. Well, I want to say also appearing in your film is another anthropologist who explained what he called the old school in English, the old school. It was a power play. And when you bring up this, the 80-year-old man, I can't think of his name now.
Tuaji.
Yes. 10 wives, and, you know, you see him at 80 years old, and, you know, the teeth aren't what they used to be, and he's speaking very calmly and logically about a heritage that comes from this. And then, did he not also marry two sisters? Is that one that married the young?
Yeah, that's what an anthropologist called sororal. all polygamy. There's two forms of polygamy. I think if you go into the Bible, levirate polygamy, which is when a man dies and then his wife marries her husband's brother. And that's one form. The other is sororal, where one man marries two sisters.
Yes.
That's not an uncommon form of polygamy cross-culturally.
And even
So two of them were sisters.
Yes.
And literally not sister wives in a generic sense, but sisters as biological sisters.
Exactly. And quite a difference in their age. And yet they seemed, I think, again, because of his age and therefore their age and how long they've been one of the 10 wives, they seemed a little more, I don't want to say accepting, but it's now what their lives have been, and they seemed more settled, that's the word I want, in their responses to your questions. But then we switched a little to the neighbors talking about him, the 80-year-old, and the old school is the more wives you have, the more powerful you were. But they were also, in addition to claiming that, they said something about people still fear, even as he is 80, they fear looking him in the eye because he has this superpower and he has been a warrior, and he admits to taking a very active role in the against the communists, etc. I know he's an example of what you're saying polygamy was, but how does that power still emanate from him today, and how does that affect his neighborhood and his neighbors?
What I found is the men who are polygamists, some but not all, but probably a majority, are what they call in Indonesia preman, which comes from the word free man, but it really is more like a gangster. They're men of violence. That's what's called in literature.
Yes.
I mean, they've been throughout Indonesian history, been utilized by different forces of the state, both the colonial and the modern state, and other to enact a variety of political and social agendas. And these guys were definitely of that ilk. They were definitely kind of gangsters. And he remains, Tuasha remains powerful, but he's wealthy.
Yes.
And he's a moneylender.
Yes.
And so he has a fearful background in the village. People know he was able and willing to commit violence to get what he wanted. He had killed a lot of people during this bloodbath in Indonesia in 1965 and 66. And he was still feared and respected, as those sort of people are in local communities when they're able to enforce their will and desire through violence. So I think the same could be said of Dharma, one of the other polygamists with five wives. It's similar. He's a gangster.
And yes.
We don't really put that forward so much in the film, but it's local knowledge.
Yes, and I'm glad you made the analogy, because I have to say, even though very subtle, I mean, you're watching something that's incredibly well done and shot and colors and, you know, editing and the music. I mean, really, I don't want to forget, we'll talk more about that, the movie making part, in the next segment. But I do want to say that as I watched it, I thought, this isn't unlike a mafioso. And he has a control over the family, the immediate family, and extending throughout the neighborhood because of his reputation, and the reputation was earned. So there. I want to talk about, since you brought up the is it Dharma with the five wives? Yes. That part of the documentary brought in to focus a little more relationship violence. And also, and I'm sorry we have to take a break, but let's put this in and we'll come back to it on the other side. Relationship violence, and that these husbands who already have several wives still partake of professional sex partners without contraception. How's that for a cliffhanger, a teaser? We'll be right back. Stay with us. We're speaking to director and producer Robert Lemelson, who has done a series of movies, documentaries, in the specializing in Southeast Asian studies. We will be right back talking more about Bitter Honey. Don't go away.
And now, another film rental discovery. Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. Only Lovers Left Alive is not really a vampire movie because there's no shock, no horror. According to Jim Jarmusch, the film's writer and director, and a granddaddy in the indie world, it's a love story and character study. It is, but it's also a film with a luscious look and feel, full of subtle detail and nuanced social commentary. Jarmusch clearly has a jaundiced view of the current state of humanity. He sets his film in decadent Tangiers and also in modern Detroit, where decay suits the mood of a very tired vamp. Humans are called zombies by the vampire elite, but it's dangerous to feed on them because so much corruption has tarnished their blood. Pure blood procured for cash from corrupt medical techs is treasured for its sensual delights. Surprisingly, Only Lovers Left Alive is an intellectual exercise suffused in a sensual world. It's a personal observation by one who sees beauty in the margins, appreciates intellectual humor, and yearns to share the pain inflicted upon the aesthete. No, this is not a driving vampire tale, but luscious vampire commentary. Only Lovers Left Alive, not in theaters, discovery through rental.
Welcome back to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. We are talking to the director of Bitter Honey, a feature-length documentary that followed three families in Bali, Indonesia for 7 years who are involved in a polygamous marriage, each of the three families. And I ended the last segment to throw out so that Robert could start with this, the possibility of relationship violence or the actual presence of that with some of the husbands, and then the practice of visiting the red light district and prostitutes without using contraception on the part of the husbands, even after they have several wives. Take it wherever you wish, Robert.
Yeah, one of the points the film makes that actually goes towards the origins of why I got involved in this project is a focus on gender-based violence. Because so I'll take a little step back, how I got into this project. I was coming off doing this multi-year project on the mass killings of 1965, which I mentioned, where
yes,
upwards of 500,000 or 1 million people were killed,
yes,
in the space of three to six months.
Yes.
Not unlike Rwanda, in terms of the kind of devastation to people's lives.
Mm.
And at the end of the Suharto period. Suharto was a dictator from,
yes,
1966. He fell in 98 in the context of the Asian economic crisis. There were these mass rapes of Chinese women in Indonesian cities, in Jakarta and Surabaya and some others, that some activists and scholars have attributed kind of to Asian provocateurs of the outgoing Suharto regime.
Mm-hmm.
So my colleagues and friends who were doing really a kind of activist program in Indonesia said, you need to do a film on this. So we started trying to interview these women, and it turned out to be a very difficult project. The women were shamed and fearful, and we really couldn't get them to open up to tell their stories. But in the context of that, we started doing work on gender-based violence in Indonesia proper. And it just so happened that in finding subjects for this research on women who had been, you know, subject to domestic violence and other forms of gender-based violence, the women we met in Bali were all in polygamous families.
Mm.
Now, that is not to say that gender-based violence is restricted to polygamy. Absolutely not. There's hundreds of thousands of cases every year,
yes,
in Indonesia, like in many societies in the world, of women getting beaten and,
yes,
abused, and I mean on a lot of levels. But since we were going down that path, polygamy seemed like a really interesting topic in which to explore that as one component.
Uh-huh.
So violence in intimate relationships is usually seen as a form of power and control.
Yes.
And it certainly operated that way in these different families. In Dharma's case, I saw the violence really as quite instrumental.
Yes.
That he had a household of four wives, and he would come, and if there were problems, he would just use his fists,
yes,
to solve problems. It was a very kind of simple and direct way. And the other story in the film, Sadra, his violence is a little more pathological. It's really more very personal and multi-generational, that he had witnessed his own father with multiple wives being exceptionally violent and brutal with them, and he was, through his own unhappiness and sense of powerlessness and desire, he would beat his wives also. Mm. And so the film explores these kind of different patterns of violence in these intimate relations, and then points towards some ways out of it for the women. What happened in the making of the film is one of the wives who was getting beaten while we were doing the project had turned to me and said, you know, can you help me? And we take a fairly concerned and collaborative and activist approach with our subjects. And so we introduced her. We first explored what could happen in the local village, because villages are run by village headmen and yes. positions of authority. But it turned out that no one in the village was willing to intervene. The police were not willing to intervene. So we turned to a human rights attorney
yes.
who kind of stepped in and did an intervention with the family that's shown in the film.
Yes.
And I'm happy to say that after the intervention, the husband stopped beating his wife, at least. I think he's still quite verbally abusive to his wives, but at least he stopped hitting them.
Yes.
So the film points towards some solutions. And finally, we're working as a production company to help set up the first gender-based violence intervention program in Bali. We're working with local social service and activists and governmental groups to raise money to do something positive with the film. So the film just doesn't educate, but actually has a role in social change.
Excellent. And it certainly is triggering a wider conversation to help. They're referred to as co-wives, or is that a term that you came up with?
Yes. Well, in Bali, in Indonesian, their bitter honey is actually madu, means honey, and
that's right. Yeah. So the second, third, and fourth, et cetera, wives are called honey. I remember that now. Yes.
Right, yeah.
Great title. So there's just so much. I mean, I know it seems like a trite question, but I'll ask it because people want to know how this works within the house. And I think your documentary points out what seems very logical, and obviously to some degree, more or less, depending on the wives and the families, but it works for them. And as you say, the alternatives are not always the best. And that's the thing we as Americans need to remember. It's not like they just say, well, I'm leaving you, and they get a divorce and they go off on their own and get a job and you know, have their own place, and everybody thinks they're wonderful people in society. It's very different. Although, I should point out, all of the wives made a point that they had their own jobs, and they were all driving around on motorbikes or motor scooters or whatever, and very proud of that sense, I believe, of their individuality and their independence. Is that going too far?
No, I think that's quite accurate. You know, one of the points, I mean, there's a couple of things that you said in terms of intimacy. People want to know, like, how do they quote
yes.
unquote do it? Either we show different aspects. So in one of the families, actually in two of the families, the wives live in entirely different villages.
Yes.
So the husband spends his time going from one compound to another,
yes.
you know, back and forth between these two entirely separate families. Now, they get together for ritual festival activities, but in general, they're separate. In Dharma's families, all four wives live together, and that's more of a difficult situation. And basically, in terms of the, you know, intimacy schedule, the husband will basically sleep on a schedule with one wife, you know, wife day on Monday, wife two on Tuesday.
I remember,
et cetera.
Forgive me, I didn't mean to.
But other than that, the wives, even though they live in the same compound, they're actually really quite separate. They don't really socialize with each other very much. They're friendly, they're cordial, but it's not like in places in sub-Saharan Africa, where polygamy is tied to subsistence economy. So in parts of sub-Saharan Africa where most of the hard agricultural work, like the hoeing and weeding
yes.
in gardens, and fields is done by women, not by the men.
Yes.
And the, when the women work together, they're actually working together every day, and it makes more of a sense why polygamy would work in that situation, because then families don't have to hire kind of wage labor, people from the outside to come in and pay them to work in the gardens. All of that kind of production of labor is in the family itself.
Yes.
So in those sort of contexts, polygamy makes some degree of sense. In Bali, it's not that way. The women are all in the market economy. They're all engaged in wage labor. They're not in some kind of subsistence, some agriculture, horticulture. And they're supporting, they're self-supporting. The women are all working. So in terms of the traditional cultural model of polygamy that the men, that we show through the puppet show in the film,
we have a
puppet show that kind of narrates the film. The cultural model is the men should be supporting. If you have multiple wives, a man, to really be a man, should financially support all his wives. And that is not the case
exactly.
In the two polygamous families in the film.
Yes, I know for one of the families, at least, the wife was quite outspoken about the fact that the husband gave her nothing. And also in another family, it wasn't clear to me that the husband was even working. It seemed, if Dharma, for instance, if I've got the correct family, didn't work, but the five wives did. And yet within the whatever was supporting this situation, the wives each had their own separate, dare I call it a studio apartment with their own kitchen. Each had their own kitchen, and they were friendly enough and communicated, as you say, when they needed to. But otherwise, they were pretty separate from one another. And maybe that's what it takes to work. I don't know. Am I remembering accurately, first of all, Robert?
Very accurately. Yeah, that is a circumstance. Dharma really is like I said, a gangster. He's
yes.
a gambler. He's a master of the cockfight.
Yes. Oh,
very,
yes.
Very big deals in Bali. They're ritualized events, and it's a semi-legal form of gambling that I can't overemphasize how central it is to Balinese masculinity.
Yes.
And the amount of time and effort and passion that men put into cockfighting is remarkable. So there's a lot of money that changes hands, and that's where he gains his money. I don't get a sense that he's really supporting the wives.
No.
With that money. That money stays for him. And then going back to another question you had about their involvement with sex workers, is these men, in addition to having multiple wives, are also quite active, you know, really being profligate in
yes.
their sexuality. They're going to brothels. They have girlfriends. So it's kind of a never-ending sexual feast for
yes.
them. Now, the part from a public health perspective that's really disturbing, that we're emphasizing in our educational programs in Indonesia, is these brothels that have sprung up all over the Balinese countryside.
Yes.
Because so much money is poured into Bali through tourism.
Yes.
And a lot of sex workers come from outside of Bali, from Java and other islands, to work in these brothels. And these are not... these are not frequented by Westerners. They're frequented by Balinese men.
Uh-huh.
This is a relatively recent phenomena, and because of a variety of factors, the HIV rate in these brothels are very, very high.
Like yes.
a quarter, 25% of the women are infected with HIV/AIDS. And so the men, because of lack of education, lack of awareness, or maybe a desire not to know, do not really have an understanding of how HIV is transferred.
Yes.
And so they're having sexual relations unprotected, and then they're going home and they're not infecting and protect potentially one wife, but maybe five. So it's really a public health nightmare. And in this sense, polygamy can become seen as almost like a death sentence.
Yes.
for these women. Now, we work very actively educating the families, talking about this, but there's only so much you can do as an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
You give them information, you talk about it, you talk about the risks, you talk about potential solutions, and you hook them up to whatever resources are available locally. But once you've done that, it's really up to the people themselves and our activists and kind of social service colleagues in Bali to pick it up and really try to make it a better situation for these women.
What are the potential solutions? I mean, do they, you mentioned social services, do they have an effective social services there in Bali?
I mean, in some domains, yes. In the domain of gender-based violence, as I mentioned before, there's not a single intervention program. So there really is almost nowhere for women to go. So we're doing fundraising through Bitter Honey. We have actually a couple local elemental employees from our production company working there, working with activists, working with psychologists, working with governmental people. We're hoping in the next 2 to 3 months we're going to have the first really integrated gender-based violence program set up. And once that's set up and it's staffed and funded, and we'll be doing fundraising for that, then these women will actually have a place to go. So we'll do educational campaigns, and women will know that there's a secure and safe place if they're getting abused in their family compound for them to get some help.
Excellent. Robert, before we run out of time, let's give whatever website we have that where people can go and find out more and also contribute to the fundraising.
Yeah, so if you go to bitterhoneyfilm.com, you can read all about the film. We're doing screenings. We're doing a one-week run this week in Los Angeles. And then if you go to the website, you can see we're going to be in San Francisco on October 17th to 23rd, in Boston the 24th to 30th. We're doing a one-week run in New York and Chicago at the end of the month into November, and then in Washington. And if you also go to the website, we have a place for more of a kind of, if you're interested and you want to donate, you want to get involved, there's places you can do that on that website, bitterhoneyfilm.com.
Excellent. Thank you for that. And I know we're short on time now, but I do want to talk a little about the actual making of the documentary. As a director, again, I tip my hat. It's incredible work. And I hope we haven't given the impression that it is depressing. It's not depressing, but it is it's mind embellishing. It's brain food. But it's also beautiful. It's beautifully done. And you capture the struggle. Some have regrets, feel trapped, but they're making the best of it. I remember one close-up in particular of the hands while the woman was trying to answer, you know, because they have to live there after you're gone. But tell us something about the actual making of it, the challenges, and the reward.
Yeah, so we, because I'm a full-time professor at UCLA, I wasn't there for 7 years. Mm. We went pretty much on summer field shoots for 2 to 4 weeks, and then sometimes, you know, during breaks at Christmas or whatever, we go for another 2 or 3 weeks. So we shot it over this long period of time. We also worked very closely with our Balinese collaborators. We have now, kind of having done this for so long, several generations, my original kind of collaborators, and now it's their children and nephews.
Wow.
Who are working with us. So, and they would sometimes also shoot when we weren't there. We give them kind of a shot list of material to get.
Uh-huh.
It was very challenging material because you're dealing with very intimate parts of people's lives.
Sure.
And exposing, you know, their sexual life, their marital life, the things that are most, you know, hurtful or destructive in their personal lives. It's a difficult, sensitive material. I do feel we've had experience having done films on genocide and
yes.
illness and the sex trade. We've worked with material like this before. And
yes.
Typically, the way you have to approach it, you have to approach it extremely ethically.
Yes.
You have to, and by that I mean, if you promise something, you come through on your promise.
Yes.
You engage your subjects as collaborators. So,
yes.
For example, some of the women in the film, we've done screenings of parts of the film to different women's organizations and villages in Bali, and the women in the film, the subjects of the film, have come and testified.
Wow.
So they're very much, very active. When we show them rough cuts and assemblies of the film, and they commented, they criticized it. So they're very active participants in the project itself. We don't just go in film something for a period of time, leave, never go back. I mean, a lot of film projects are done like that.
Yes, yes.
We have a very active involved. As an anthropologist, I kind of have to do it that way.
Exactly. And it shows.
Yeah, it's my field.
It shows in the footage. It shows in the interviews, the one-on-one, and even the, I mean, there was one scene in which the interview was the husband sitting between the two wives, and the body language that you captured and still allowed them to express themselves, and just to see the range of emotions, both spoken and unspoken. I'm sure you were aware of that as you were shooting it, but how do you make that a work of art, a documentary, without being caught up in it, or is being caught up in it exactly what you want?
Yeah, it's part of it is behaving ethically, and then also approaching it professionally, shooting it professionally.
Yes.
I'm lucky to work with a really great team of people at Elemental. You know, we're in LA. LA,
yes.
Hollywood,
yes.
Has really great resources for filmmaking. We're the best in the world are here. So I've been really quite lucky to work with great film. The director of photography, Wing Ko, I've worked with for 15 years. My editor, Kisako, has worked on this project for at least 5 or 6 years. So it's long-term collaborative relationships with the team here. This filmmaking is collaborative. It's not.
Yes.
I did not make the film. The team made the film. It would not have been done, would not have been possible for an individual to make it. It has to be done collaboratively. So, so in terms of understanding their dynamics, it's, you know, I, as an anthropologist, I speak fluent Indonesian.
Yes, yes.
And I've worked in many different contexts. I've done thousands and thousands of hours of interviews. So I'm pretty aware of what's going on,
yes.
Of the meaning, cultural difference, meaning of body language, of gesture, of emotional tone in people's voices, and you pay attention to that.
Excellent. Well, it's we see that. We see that you know exactly what you're doing, and this relationship of culture is why I think the documentary Bitter Honey is a must-see. I'm afraid we're out of time, but we have been talking to Elemental Productions' Robert Lemelson, who is the director of the feature-length documentary Bitter Honey. Robert, thank you so very much for being on the show. And
thanks for your show. Great.
Okay. You best in all the future, too. Bye now.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Stay with us, as we'll be right back with a final comment from The Reasonable Voice.
And now, another film rental discovery.
Welcome to the Indie Film Minute. It started in 1993 with Pure Evil. 3 8-year-old boys found hogtied and butchered in West Memphis, Arkansas. 3 teenagers arrested, clearly drunk on sinister music and devil worship, exuding satanic presence. 1 even confessed. Kill them, cried the community. Guilty, said the police, the prosecutor, the judge. 4 documentary films tell of the same horrifying events. Paradise Lost, Child Murders at Robin Hood Hills was the first, a standalone masterpiece that provides incredible insights from every side. The police, the families, the prosecutors, the judge, and the defendants. A simple story no more. Guilt settled. Truth in question. 2 sequels update the story. New revelations, new questions. A miscarriage of justice? Likely. Did we need a 4th film? Absolutely. The first tells the hideous tale in real time as it unfolds. With the benefit of hindsight, West of Memphis fills in the rest of the story. The real story. Ultimately, the West Memphis 3 were released after 18 years on an Alford plea, which asserts innocence while acknowledging damning evidence. Face saving for the system and justice for none. Paradise Lost and West of Memphis. Not in theaters. Discovery through rental.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us and becoming one of the reasonable voices heard around the world. Lessons from political thugs and corporate bullies. I normally resist finger-pointing like hindsight worshippers, but sometimes we fail to see the lesson without some if-onlys and what-ifs. For example, forgetting the Soviet missiles of October 1962 Cuba, when Red Army Army ground commanders were authorized to launch nuclear missiles at the southeastern third of America like a hellfire hurricane season, we might miss in 2014 Russia that thugs need to prove themselves worthy of more global attention than we give global warming. Hopefully, this MH17 tragedy will awaken Europe to their Putin financial hypocrisy as it shames his missile-launching minions stealing away into the dark side in which bullies are inspired. Indeed, there's enough worldwide liability and culpability to dangerously increase the temperature of the Earth's surface. But let's allow the United Nations to be our torch for truth. It will not resurrect the 298 lost, but it should resurrect civil demand for global accountability from all nations. If only the people of Germany and America had made their governments heed the Russian-Ukraine warming warning from the U.S. commander of NATO in Europe, General Philip Breedlove, as actionable intelligence. What if Christian love encouraged free will that honored Mandela, Moonwalk, and Elaine Stritch by giving every human being a love thy neighbor as thyself embrace? If only to our climate change we speak truth, then it must follow as civil outrage the EFM Detroit water shutoff, we must be true to our exceptionalism and will not be victimized by any violence-inspired Putin, self-appointed anti-children border militia, or Koch Industries allies. What if America can't wait for Hillary's hammer? Should we then not vote Obama a majority in both our congressional houses, if only to counterbalance the five politicized male Supreme Court justices? If only we the people stop returning to the sources of our problems for our solutions, but rather learn the correct lessons from behind closed doors ballot manipulations, whether they be Florida's 2000 Broward and Palm Beach counties or 2014 Mississippi Chris McDaniel staff. Let's expose myths told by Southern Tea Party leadership, the truth of Walmart and Amazon sweatshops, the inevitability of blindsiding Florida with climate change denials, and a global warming Atlantic and Gulf drowning our grandchildren. What if the Obamacare political liability for Democrats isn't the lesson, but rather the mental and physical health dangers to Republicans whose red state governors deny them the benefits of the Affordable Care Act? Listen, we can insist on a judicial system blind to gender, race, and sexual preferences, or we can share the corporate responsibility for the disease, homelessness, and contagious health hazards that result from shutting off Detroit water. We can be solutions for Western drought and wildfires, and 43-year-old New York City father's police-influenced death, or we can accept liability for what we leave our grandchildren. Join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world. Thank you.
Thank you for continuing to listen to, support, and share the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio with family and friends, especially online. We enjoy hearing from you, and in response, yes, we are now accepting new company and business advertisers and welcoming organizations seeking to be one of our sponsors. So please do continue to email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com. However, if you prefer to simply make a donation, your donations are greatly appreciated and can be made through PayPal by clicking on the donate button found at the top of the homepage of the Reasonable Voice. Voice.com website.
Thank you for joining us today to make every day as reasonable as possible. We hope you will download and share our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.